Each one of you is a special guest for tonight's feast of oral, acoustic, and cerebral delights. Philosopher, novelist, and critic William H. Gass is a diamond cutter among wordsmiths. His first novel, Omensetter's Bluff, which explores the myth of the natural man in American literature, was hailed as an astonishing total performance by Yale critic John Hollander. His collection of stories, In the Heart of the Country, boldly explores the territory of the self amid symbolic landscapes of language. He causes the ear to think. He creates forms that defy traditional forms. Bill Gass is ornery and articulate. He has created The World Within the Word, Fiction and the Figures of Life, Willie Masters' Lonesome Wife, On Being Blue, and more. In any century, there are a few hundred great novelists and poets, a handful of true philosophers, and even fewer great critics. It is my pleasure to introduce a man who brilliantly encompasses all three roles, William H. Gass.
I'd like to begin this reading with three brief poems of Rainer Maria Rilke's, which I have recently translated. The first is about music. The other two are overtly about parting and about the season of autumn, but they're really about that strangely enduring yet evanescent motion, which is music, too. To music. Music. Breathing of statues. Possibly stillness in pictures. Speech where speech ends. Time upright and poised upon the passing of our passions. Yet feelings for whom? You are the alteration of all feeling. Into what? Audible landscape. You stranger. Music. Heart space that's outgrown us. Innermost us which it scaled, surmounted, gone beyond. Into holiest absence. Where what's within surrounds us the way the most skillful horizon does, or the other side of the air. Pure, immense, no longer lived in. Parting. How I have felt it, that nameless state called parting, and how I feel it still, a dark, sharp, heartless something that displays, holds out with unapparent hands a perfect union to us, while tearing it in two. With what wide open eyes I've watched whatever was, while calling to me, loosening its hold, remaining in the road behind, as though all womankind, yet small and white and nothing more than this, a waving which has blown the hair beyond its brow, a slight, continuous flutter, scarcely now explicable. perhaps, the tremor of a plum tree, and the bough a startled cuckoo has set free. Finally, autumn. The leaves are falling from far away, as though a distant garden died above us. They fall with denial in their wave. And through the night, the hard earth falls farther than the stars in solitude. We all are falling. Here, this hand falls, and see, there goes another. It's in us all. And yet there's one whose gently holding hands let this falling fall and never land. Of course, we shall now land with a thump upon poor old prose. It is perhaps the floor in the pantheon of the great arts, upon which everyone walks, and I suppose justly too, for prose does lie very near the earth, and often lacks that informing spirit, that sense of interior shapeliness, which is so essential to the emotional elevation in poetry and painting and music. It is, of course, poetry which has made it a habit to call out for divine aid, to invoke the muse. Homer did it. Virgil asked for such assistance twice in the same poem. Milton, too, and many others. It's customary. However, the novel needs more than normally the assistance of the muse. It needs the muse of stubborn persistence, of obsession, the muse for long and laborious distances. Yet if the muse of music does not come, if the prose does not sing one sort of song or other the entire trip, that distance will seem long and dull and hard indeed. The narrator of my novel, The Tunnel, in whose narrow and dirty passages I have been digging for some years, is an heroically mean-spirited and overweight historian whose subject is Nazi Germany. Erudite, sensitive, passionate, generous, his own description, he is also disappointed, resentful, misanthropic. So on his behalf, I thought it advisable to invoke the muse too. His grant application, as it were, takes up the entire second section of the book and is some 70 pages long. To some, that may seem excessive, but William Frederick Kohler needs all the help he can get. Anyway, here is a piece of that appeal. In the old days, before beginning and in order to continue, they always asked for celestial aid. Bless these boats and make them safe. Guide my faltering steps. Strengthen my arm and sharpen my sword. Preserve my penis from the pox, O Lord. Like pants from a weakened waistband, there has been a certain sliding down of expectation. O goddess of the risen gorge. Everywhere, nothing now but a revocation of the muse. Cancel Cleo, cross out sweet Calliope, for history's been buggered by ideology and farts its facts in an odorous cloud. While poets have no breath whatever, are in another business presently, where Parnassus is a pastry, and produce their poems promptly on request, like short order cooks shake forth a batch of fries. Mark out Melpomene. The lives of the anonymous are nothing like the lives of the saints. A celebrity is but a draft from his fans. Crooks establish dynasties on stolen dimes, and slips of policy feed greasy Sicilian Caesars, who are all, one hopes, predamned the way our postage is prepaid. Then politicians nowadays are as unlikely subjects for tragedy as dung dropped from the bronze horses of their predecessors, while the otherwise so-called great have all the substance of a cunt-encouraged cheer from the stands. Erase errata well, since sex is smut, a kind of commercial cleansing candy. Euterpe too, because the flute which gladdens is a kid's kazoo, and comedy a laughing stock. Tear Terpsichore in two like a losing ticket. We do not dance these days. We march. We stomp. As for polyhymnia, where everything's a sewer, what is sacred? Soccer? And the heavens, like Urania herself, were buried long ago beneath the battlefield where we did in the planets and drove the constellations like fattened cattle to the abattoirs. Shall I call up the crafts of conservation, lemon and brandy, honey and sunshine, salt and wine, the lava and ice which slew and saved the saber tooth, marooned Pompeii's indulgent daily life on an isle out of time? Should I muster all the ancient arts of preservation? Disembowelment, embalmment, mummification? The dry stone tomb, Etna's immortalizing crater. Can my crabby complaints, my discontents, be stored like grain against that unlikely lean year when there is a famine in misfortune? Can my curses be kept calm in a cool cellar, my harvest of sour grapes tunned like a vintage, and can all my cruelty of mind come powdered in a package like dried milk or jello? During the Depression, when my family bought canned fruits and vegetables by the case in order to save, it was my job to arrange our hoard on shelves in the basement. But is there anything in life now I wish to Leninize, so mobs may march by and be edified? Anything I would like to bottle and lay down for the next decade to enjoy? Have I some favorite fish to barrel, smoke, bury in brine, release in an ocean of oil? A flounce from your stew, you sluttish muse, and bring me a pleasant subject. O brood, O muse, upon my mighty theme, like a holy hen upon the nest of night. O ponder the fascism of the heart. Sing of disappointments more repeated than the batter of the sea, of lives embittered by resentments so ubiquitous the ocean's salt seems thinly shaken, of letdowns local as the sofa where I copped my freshman's feel, of failures as frequent as first nights, first love, last stands. Do not warble of arms or adventurous deeds or shepherds playing on their private fiefs, or of civil war or monarchies at swords. Consider rather the slightly squinkered clerk, the soul which has become as shabby and soiled in its seat as worn-out underwear, a life lit like a lonely room and run like a laddered stocking. Behold the sagging tit, the drudge-gray, mopped-out, cunt-corked wife, stale as yesterday's soapy water. Or study the shiftless kid, seedy before any bloom, thin and mean as a weed in a walk. Smell the grease that stands rancid in the pan like a second skin, the pan aslant on some fuel-farting stove, the stove in its corner contributing what it can to the brutal conviviality of close quarters. Let depression, like time payments, weigh you down. Feel desperation and despair like dust thick in the rug and the ragged curtains, or carry puppy pee and plate scrapings wrapped in the colored pages of the Sunday paper out to to the loose and blowing dog-jawed heap in the alley. Spend your money on large cars, loud clothes, sofa-sized paintings, excursions to Hawaii, trinkets, knick-knacks, fast food, golf clubs, call girls, slimming salons, booze. Suffer shouting, heat rash, chilblains, beatings, betrayal, guilt, impotence, jail, jealousy, humiliation, VD, vermin, stink. Sweat through a St. Louis summer and sing of that. You will not be surprised to learn that the muse has resolutely refused to appear. But we are not an unmusical people, we prose writers. Like Thomas Mann, we can imagine a composer's whole career. And sometimes one is called upon, by the project underway, to write loads of little songs and jingles. For instance, there is in this novel a cabaret singer named Susu, and so it became necessary for me to write the lyrics of several such songs. Here's one called Crow, which we are to imagine is being sung in a smoky cellar by someone resembling Marlene Dietrich. Crow, oh crow, don't cross my path, so my life lasts a little longer. Crow, oh crow, each time you pass, my sickness grows a little stronger. I love you so, who would believe it? But there's no death that I don't breathe it. I'm Carrion Crow, how well you know me, my head and chest, the parts below me. So go then, go, sup on my body, wipe dry my plate of any bloody. And even though that piece you've taken is all my heart hate hasn't eaten, you're welcome. No, I don't begrudge it. Quick with your beak so teeth won't touch it. And let me show the honest of my bones, my jaw, its laughter, joy as never, whatever's after. Not very entertaining, but it's supposed to be in German. Among the more odorous characters in this novel, and that's going some, is a colleague of Kohler's called Culp. He is, among other things, composing a limerical history of the human race. Also a cycle of indecent limericks, 25 in number, each with the same first line. I once went to bed with a nun. Culp is himself a cartoon, a limerick, a pun. He is made of the noises he makes. Here are a few paragraphs about him, done staccato. Culp claims to be an historian. He claims a special knowledge of the American Indian. He heads up a troop of scouts. They make moccasins and wear them on hikes. They make arrowheads out of flints, bows from the bushes, tomahawks out of stones tied to sticks, headdresses from the feathers of table turkeys and city pigeons, pemmican from stale beef, rancid suet, and raisins only rabbits drop, all pounded into splats with a wooden mallet, and then shaped into sticky, indestructible cakes. Survival rations. Good against the bomb. His kids paint their faces with berry juice and dance as though demented in ungainly figure eights. They like to take overnights, sleep on the ground, cook in tin cans like tramps, sing around a dying fire. Culp also knows about corn silk and canoes, and he has memorized some Indian chat, or so he claims, which charms the children, perhaps because his flat cheeks puff. But I think it's because they adore adults in Culp coinage, who play the fool and make themselves look ridiculous like those out-of-work whites who imitate Indians in the movies. Any sort of savage, thuggy, fuzzy-wuzzy, all the same. Cope, though, believes. He believes in the superiority of Indian culture and the red race. He believes that Indian blankets are better than Persian rugs, that Indian horses never stumble, tire, grow old, or leave tracks, that Indian arrows fly true, that their medicine men know both men and medicine in a deep mystical sense and perform miracles as easily as we cut corns, that their squaws sow and serve, their elders advise wisely, passing the pipe of peace from hand to hand and measuring the present by the sacred practices of the past. But most of all, Cope believes that the Indian is untiring, stealthy, resourceful, and stoically brave. Cope is a man of cliché, the way some men are men of the cloth. He believes that societies without writing are spiritually free, not stupidly becalmed. He believes in killing and roasting your own meat, growing your own grain, cleaning your own fish, tanning your own hides, slaying your enemies and settling scores, living as the sun and the snow and the seasons demand, following the great herds, worshiping bears and snakes. Though Cope's features are far from Indian, he is lean and swarthy, with dark eyes. From a distance, he seems presentable and reasonable enough. Approach, however, and you'll hear whirs and clicks, rhymes and puns, jocularities in dialect, jingles in dirty high schoolese. Gibberish, he says, is pure Sioux. Cope's incessant zits, yelps, zooms, and howls intervene in meaning and carry on the action. If his pickup hasn't started, first we hear last night's icy wind and the oil in the engine thicken. The truck's doors open with a groan, which he gives us. His trousers slither over the cold seat and the key nicks, entering its lock. The engine's frozen agonies are minutely replayed. The starter's grind, the muffled puff of a single cylinder firing, the smell of a flooded engine is delicately rendered by, as if from a distance, the bassoon. Finally, zerbloom, gloom, room, room, room. His right hand suddenly becomes a dinky little car puck, puck, pucketing along toward school. He was brought up on Mickey Mouse and Porky Pig. He falsettos in fright, he zips, he squeals to a halt, he varooms, he tisks, he thonks. He does all the Popeye voices, but prefers olive oils. Concrete is his whole musique. Don't ask him the time. He'll tell you it's dong, 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 a ding, and 10 ticks. Cope, of course, whistles. Birds, sirens, the wolf call, cops, quitting, not Mozart, not Bach, but the whistler and his dog. As for those limericks I said he composed and is himself constructed of, here are quickly three. I once went to bed with a nun who had screwed every nation but one. I don't want a Russia, but your pole feels like Prussia, far too chilly to finish the pun. For hangovers, it was my habit to find the hair of the dog and then grab it. But one maddened hatter ended that matter when the hair wasn't Welsh, it was rabbit. And my own invention, the lengthened limerick. I once went to bed with a nun as a master of arts, not for fun. She was eager to learn and had passion to burn and was so apt in class, I put A on her ass. But she wouldn't take credit, though she smiled when she said it. Your designs may be polished, Herr Prof, by your knowledge, but the smarts of your parts are homespun. Let us release the doggerel muse to her dinner. Among the musical forms I like to employ is one I call the catalog aria. Now, formerly, we had descriptions of music, then song lyrics and jingles, and a man made of music like one made of snow or gingerbread. Here, however, is melodically a melodically organized list. But by that I mean that perhaps the controlling principle of the order of the items on that list is a musical one. In this aria, my narrator, Kohler, is recalling simply the things and people who gathered in his little Iowa hometown during the Dust Bowl days to celebrate a wedding. Ponderous aunts and uncles, uncles lean as withered beans, aunts pale as pie crust, grandmapas with rheum and gout, cousins shrill as sirens sounding themselves through the house like warnings of death from the air. Later, in London, I heard them often. Cousins who scratched you under the table, cousins all agloat who told on other cousins, cousins who scooped up fistfuls of mashed potato and let it slime over their wrists, aunts who wore hats in the house, aunts who starched and ironed linens, aunts who stirred pots, flagellated rugs, opened doors for dogs, swatted flies, and reminisced fondly of death and diseases as if they were high school dances, former flames. Uncles and great uncles who, like the hoppers, spat long brown jets of chewing tobacco across the railings while they rocked. Nieces and nephews, a few of those too, who peed in their pants, threw up, bawled, and beat you on the shins and ankles with alphabet blocks. Relatives at every conceivable remove, but not removed, each noisily present. Then friends of both the bride and groom who came to cry and nudge and slap and snicker, and all of the groom's loose connections, countless, no easier to bear, no simpler to ignore. Swedes, Danes, Germans mainly, mostly Lutheran, though a few were Catholic from the German South, even poorer, much despised. And uncles who argued, and uncles who only grunted, and one who restrained the flow from his nose with sniffs like tearing paper. Aunts who mended clothes like surgeons, nephews who instantly re-injured them. Aunts with moist wads, bald and moister hands, who toiled up and down the day-long stairs on legs like fat raw sausages. Many mothers, of course, and fathers, my own among them, not then crippled, not then drunken, mother hurt and father angry, always, and the aunts with hats who sighed with such expression you'd have thought they were blowing kazoos, and those who took second helpings with a coy, apologetic lurch, holding down the struggling meat with the flats of their knives, and the men who drank in the barn like small boys sneaking a smoke and told jokes about farm wives and stallions, farm boys and sheep, or bragged of the shitting prowess of their huge, brown, singularly boweled cows. The cousins who tried to climb drain pipes, the one who wanted me to kiss her warts, but who wouldn't tell me where the warts were. Cousins who took out the slops, uncles who philosophized, or otherwise explain things, creating in the house the noise of straining tractors. Uncles who were proud they could piss like a horse and who ingested certain liquids to permit them to continue to. Gramps who burned their pockets with pipes and their absent minds with yearning. Grams who were already laid out in their knitting baskets, needles crossed, who couldn't hear a word they were so far away, vacationing in death. Aunts in aprons, uncles in knuckles and sun wrinkles, wash-faded shirts, slack suspenders, bruised arms and metal-hooking high shoes with dirt-clogged laces, who lost their spectacles on their noses, as the ants did, or on mantles, on tables, or failed to observe them, caught like enormous dragonflies in the jaws of books, the lips of sofas, as here and there, scarcely noticed, in water glasses, softly leaning, sunken teeth set in sick pink gums. And there were many violet-brown photographs of babies held in heavy albums as though by Negro mammies, girls in high-necked blouses, men with shiny hair and youthful mustaches, no limper, certainly, than Rilke's, and one which I particularly remember of my father in smile tie, button sweater, cloth cap, pride and knickers, standing on a dirt road and displaying by its tail, as you might a prize fish, a 6-foot snake. There were reproductions, too, of moonlit canoes and falling water, squeezed in frames of unpeeled birch, the tame Indians sold to the savage tourists. Mottos burned into slices of that same romantic wood. A finger-pointing figure of Jesus. Heavy-cut glass fruit bowls, which were always empty. Bud vases, which were tippy. Pin cushions, which were busy, stiff, and dangerous. A gramophone with horn and dog. Some copies of The Delineator. Sheet music. And a many-volumed, richly pictured history of the Great War. The taxicabs at the Marne, Italians levering their own cannons off an alpine cliff, impressive piles of something dead in pools of trenchy water. Spads and Fokkers in gentlemanly jousts, and the fearsome Boche parading in long lines, spikes on their hats, not a gentleman under them, hats which were, I'd thought, once upon that time, for butting. In close quarters, hand to hand, you lowered your head and wham, right in the belly. Then a novel called The Man Thou Gavest, Dana, Alcott, Henty. Dresser scarves the purpling red of a blown rose, lamps with glass shades like chambermaids' caps, pots of sick ivy, one hand-painted ashtray from Baden in the shape of a softened triangle like Susu's ferocious head. A heavy oval mirror looped with gilt cord, goblets of cobbled glass, thread-bearing rugs, something thick by Teddy Roosevelt, two battered silver trays shadowy with tarnish, Malacca cane on which something vaguely menacing was written in Hong Kongese, and three cheap, tiny china slippers the color of cream. Souvenir fans, and perched on rails near the ceiling, like mothy, stuffed exotic birds, decorative plates in every shape but round, often with their edges gnawed just like the uncles were, whom whole families had eaten from for years and bitten too, in haste, in need. All of them images and photos now, aunts, uncles, objects, the faded tracings of earlier ages, as were the many trinkets which had been carried from the old country, views of the Rhine seen through the stereopticon, paperweights with blizzards which could be shaken up inside them, dolls which had grown old, remaining the same age, washed, not moved, by time, wooden acrobats whose tights had flaked away, leaving them nude but innocuous, since their genitals having a greater affection for the cloth they were kept in than the crotches they hung from were absent too. And I can imagine these patient ants and their unfeeling needles mending the vaginal slits in bloomers, ironing out the dents put in blouses by the breasts which still fit in them, scrubbing the skin in shirts and dresses. For if I had a choice and were their parts, I'd leave like the acrobats, preferring the fate of worn-out clothing to the fate of worn-out men. The land swallowed them. Toil took them. Wood-burning stoves and childbearing, pots, pans, curtains, livestock, gardens, all the sorry work upon the land, all that worry for the earth and its objects, the careful crops, the tireless and terrible tending they were broken to, as though the world around them were someone sick in a sick room breathing its last. So that even the preparations for the wedding, even the pies that were baked, the huge stews, soups, and kettles of beans, the barrels of sauerkraut, the strings of stool-like sausage, the hot hours of canning, deprived them of what they intended to sustain and were, with these labors, celebrating. Had a little of this time and this devotion been given to thought or to feeling, to the cultivation of some sense of themselves which went beyond the dray horse, if some small effort had gone into renewing sensation, into a passion for beauty, the elevation of desire, into love. Someone save the word, "I am unable." Then perhaps just possibly. But the load was too heavy, the sky too great an enemy, and they lived the lives they lived like hoe handles, as washerwomen, cooks, wombs, silos, as physical locations. And now they were grandpas and grandmas, aunts and uncles, tired and tiresome, victims of the bodies they had used like plows upon themselves. For they were prairies, too, desiccated, wind-swept places. And the dust from their own dryness had come for them at last, had risen from their own abused bodies as that greater dust had risen from a dry, abused land. And now, staining them as deeply as crazed plates, it settled back in answer to a cry from their birth for an end. And it was appropriate, only right, as a sign from God or from the selves they might have been, that occasionally the substance which made the symbol should multiply itself, seek something in hyperbola which otherwise could not be reached, and so, like an ash of morning, large as night, become monstrously manifest in a whirling wind, a plague of locusts, or a storm of dust, until it finally caused the deaths it all along had been an emblem and a warning of. The fugue is the best form for the childlike complaint and for the family quarrel. Of course, one cannot write fugues in words, but one can, I think, make one's structure seem, at times, at least a little fugato. My dad wouldn't let me have a dog. A dog? A dog we don't need. My mom made the neighbor's spitz her pal by poisoning it with the gin she sprinkled on the table scraps. Feed it somewhere else, my dad said. A dog we don't need. My dad wouldn't let me have a dog. Our neighbor's spitz, that mutt, he shits in the flower beds. Dog do we don't need. At least feed it somewhere else, my dad said. My mom made the table scraps tasty for her pal, the neighbor's spitz, that mutt, by sprinkling them with gin. You're poisoning, pal, my dad said, but never mind, we don't need that mutt. My mom thought anything tasted better with a little gin to salt it up. That way, my mom made the neighbor's spitz her pal and maddened dad, who wouldn't let me have a dog. He always said we didn't need one. They crapped on the carpet and put dirty paws on the pants legs of guests and yapped at cats or anyone who came to the door. A dog we don't need. We don't need chewed shoes and dog hairs on the sofa, fleas in the rug, dirty bowls in every corner of the kitchen, dog stink on our clothes. But my mom made the neighbor's spitz her pal anyway by poisoning it with the gin she sprinkled on the table scraps like she was baptizing bones. At least feed it somewhere else, my dad said. My dad wouldn't let me have a pal. Who will have to walk that pal, he said. I will. and it's going to be snowing, or it's going to be raining, and who will be waiting by the vacant lot at the corner in the cold, wet wind, waiting for that damn dog to do his business? Not you, Billy boy. Christ, you can't even be counted on to bring in the garbage cans or mow the lawn. So, no dog. A mutt we don't need. We don't need dog dew in the flower beds, chewed shoes, fleas. What we need is the yard raked, like I said this morning. No damn dog. No mutt for your mother, either, even if she tries to get around me by feeding it when my back is turned, when I'm away at work earning her gin money so the sick thing can shit in the stream on the flower seeds. At least she should feed it somewhere else. It's always hanging around. Is it a light string in the hall or a cloth on the table to be always hanging around? No. Chewed shoes, fleas, muddy paws, and yappy daddle, Bowser odor, a dog we don't need. Suppose it bites the postman. Do you get sued? No. I am the one waiting at the corner vacant lot in the rain, the snow, the cold, wet wind, waiting for the dog to do his damn business, and I get sued. You don't. Christ, you can't even be accounted on to clip the hedge. You know, snick snack. So, no dog, my dad said. Though we had a dog, nevertheless. That is, my mom made the neighbor's pal her mutt and wouldn't let me have him for mine either, because it just followed her around, yip-nip, waiting to lap gin and nose its grease-wet bread. So we did have a dog in the house, even though it just visited, and it would rest its white head in my mom's lap and whimper, and my father would throw down his paper and say, shit, and I would walk out of the house and neglect to mow or rake the yard or snick-snack the hedge or bring the garbage cans around. My dad wouldn't let me have a dog. A dog? A dog we don't need, he said. So I was damned if I would fetch. It may be folly for a prose writer to hold a poet's ideal as his own, especially when that poet is Mallarmé, and when Mallarmé's own aims are musical. But the elusive Frenchman once said, and I'm quoting, "We are now precisely at the moment of seeking before that breaking up of the large rhythms of literature and their scattering in articulate, almost instrumental nervous waves. An art which shall complete the transposition in the book of the symphony, or simply recapture our own. For it is not in elementary sonorities of brass, strings, wood, unquestionably, but in the intellectual word at its utmost, that fully and evidently we should find, drawing to itself all the correspondences of the universe, the supreme music." I want to close, then, with this brief but rather more unified composition, which concerns one important moment in my narrator's love affair with his much younger mistress, a woman named Lou, called August Bees. Now it is another day. Rain is speaking gently to the terrace. I speak gently, sometimes, to myself. How soft the light is, mingled with the wet. We had one shortened summer month together, Lou and I. My God, even the decade's gone. Pleading the pressures of work, I excused myself from my life and settled in a second-story room in western New York. A wooden stair fell from one widened window like a slide of cards. We hung our towels there, a shirt sometimes, a slip as discreet as a leer. I remember particularly the quiet, empty streets, the long walk to the beach. Well, it was scarcely a beach, though there was a pier, and even in August, the water was cool in those thin, deep lakes, the patient passion of the glaciers scratched. My chief memory is the heat, the silence, your pale breasts, pale as a bleached leaf. I do not understand what makes another body so appealing. A souvenir scarf, salmon pink and exuberantly fringed, but not a memory of mine, lay across the dresser. And there was an old oak commode, solid as a safe. I also recall one stiff chair, committed to good posture and discomfort, its caning gone and the hole boarded up like a broken window, with the seat wood covered in some kind of slippery cloth on which designs suggestive of breakfast commanded the eater to be shortly up and at him. Well, so there were these wan, leftover creatures still. The glass dish your hairpins lay in, a distant green like some remembered portion of the sea. So from the side, the pins seemed a school of small fish. The lamp which leaned, threatening to slide the shade outside the limits of its bulb shine. The black metal basket where an orange flower flared like a match, and where you would toss the Kleenex you wiped yourself with, seed-soaked, relaxed in a soft wad. So, these things. Then you and I. We were wonderful in our willingness, weren't we? You and I, then. And now, is it all ash? Some sweetmeat scrubbed from the teeth? These days, the soft cloth which receives my relief gets washed. And the walls. The walls were... damn. There was a rug. Yes, there was a rug. It's designed by a dime store Indian. And didn't we have a clock we kept in the pocket of its case? Somewhere a quiet tick, a measure we forgot. The picture you wanted to turn to the wall was, of a Civil War encampment. If you grasped that stair rail, white paint would powder your hand. Now I had captured your love, I was already counting the cost. Every morning we ate an orange, and you walked off to the lake to swim while I read until 11 when I met you there. We circled the lake so closely we kept our image always in the water, and we ate our lunch from the same brown sack we used to feed the ducks, the sack the grocer dropped our oranges in, half a dozen at a time. The scent of the peel would often linger on my thumbs, the zest of the rind still lodged beneath the nail near the quick. Then in the afternoon we would nap and sweat through the deep heat, our limbs loose as rags, and walk once more down the elm-tented street for a dip, holding hands which had held our bodies together better than our bones. In the evenings I wrote, or we listened to the radio a little, and you would let your long hair dry on our single pillow. It was the simplest sort of life, empty of everything except ourselves, the contentment we were wrapped in, like patriotic bunting. I wrote the section of guilt and innocence on secondary school almost entirely out of my head, easily even the songs. Unsern Führer, lieber wir, unsern Führer, ehren wir, unsern Führer, folgen wir, bis wir Männer werden, hardly taking thought. Bugs would bang against the screen during the early hours of the night. A car might cough, or very far away, a truck labor up a hill, and the morning light would be gray and heavy with humidity. I would stand naked at the top of our wooden stairs while you completed your sleep, accosting a day which wasn't quite ready, and waiting for a breeze to brush the hair on my legs the way your breath would caress me in advance of your tongue. We were happy because we had no history. I know that now, though I was writing what is called history. I wrote Guilt and Innocence in Hitler's Germany, Chapter 12. Our winter room was as full of the snow which had fallen between us, the cold wind my wife blew, your desire to have all of me, as though I were entirely at leisure and had no book, no profession, no family, no commitments to the world. I only wanted to play Eeny, Miny, Minnie Moo, and you eventually tired of being a meadow for my slow, fat herds. But in that warm, still, heavy summer, even the stars were wet, and I would wait for a wind, a faint stir in the grass tips, that movement of light, life in the poplars, which signified a breeze. And through the screen, with its fly's eye view, watch the light slide along your body as if that were air, too, suddenly become skin. It sometimes seems to me, in morbidly fanciful moments, as if age were aimed at, not simply suffered. For I fled my youth as if it were a disease. I wanted adolescence as I wanted its acne. And I can believe those who argue that memory is not enough to establish the reality of the self. Because the selves I remember like photos in the family album. That knickered kid, that bald, scrawny brat, that fuzz and fat-faced second Louis, that solemn owl in his flat black hat. They are relatives of mine at best, school chums, scarcely recollected, unidentified individuals who have somehow slunk into the group and grin at the blank beside their name. I can unearth someone shouting slogans in a German street, but that loud rowdy could never have been played by the soft-voiced and suety professor I have since become. Nor can I long for you any longer in the old way. That pain is also past. Since the lover who lingered over you like a nurse through an illness, I see that now, is now another man, no longer a lover of any kind, just as you are, Lou, a different set of lips, another pair of breasts, some further furry tunnel. How odd it must seem to that murderer of Jews who is apprehended in his watch shop in Ulm and his ghost dragged away to justice. I am not that man, he wants to say. Those letters and diaries that accuse me accuse a photograph, a faded paper image. Well, I always am and never was. But who wants to be what they have been? Only those like Lou, whose souls are the same as their skins, those whose bodies have beauty and skill, grace and accomplishment, the ball player, the harlot, the model, the dancer, the beach boy, any bebuggered beauty. Time is an enemy of matter, not of mind. And history, as I said to Governale, history, so long as it is tied to time like a tin can to the wedding car, can only be a recital of tents. There were tents, men slouching in grain sacky heaps, stacked arms. Oh no, I'm not your second story man anymore. Another story has intervened. The beauty which I had from you, tents. Tired men, smoke, still air, stacked arms. The pale pattern of your bra, like something which has lain too long across grass, as that scarf lay across its dresser, is one I watch a former self observe. A self which could have returned through the screen to spread itself like a brown glaze over your breasts. Not this body, which is all mine now, and a mind which is pure bleach. You turned the tents to the wall, hid the huddles of men, the limp flag, the dog. There was, of course, an amber patch behind it, and its paperback was brown and parched and marked with black crayon a line of dust along the wire. The shadow of its neglect lay upon it, the paper dry and drawn up tight till it tore where it drew back from its glue. Yet you preferred the blank backside of the image. The hammered frame back there was smooth. And now I know what the walls were. I have recovered the color of unskimmed cream. That one small room made us more than normally neat. We so rubbed and moistened one another, we did not disturb the collar stay on the other window's windowsill or the pin in the corner by the hall door. We spent whole days consuming an hour. We were rich. We made hay. Sunshine fell like a shower. We bathed. Well, I regret the loss of the lover who loved you. Hourly, I regret it. But not the loss of the slogan shouter, the maker of messes I once was. The fingers which slipped through the enchanted forest of your twat, I promise, did not heft that rock on Kristallnacht. It's as if my 40s had canceled my 20s out and my 50s stamped paid on both. And beyond the tents, the men, the tented arms, I think I see a station, stacks of wood. There were a few beards on the men and many small mustaches. This was a world, our old world, turned to the wall, like the cliché said. Some were sitting cross-legged. I remember particularly our sandaled footfalls and your hand, the light way it led the swing of our arms. Suddenly, the temperature fell like a stone scuffed over a cliff, and when you woke, as surprised by the chill as the trees, I tossed you a towel to cover yourself, and you held to your breasts half a dozen honeybees which had sought shelter in its folds. But chapter 12 of Guilt and Innocence had come from my head like a flow of tears. And I remember I wanted the gaze of my healthy German kids, the pure shine of the facts, to concentrate in the nib of my pen. Look back at my words, the way those men stared, as they had to, stolidly at the lens, into the heart of the black hood, which would eventually hold all that remained of their lives. Poets are the bees of the invisible, Rilke said. A stray strand of hair ran like a crack across your chest. Am I still that astonished self, that innocent who attacked you from afar? Later, small red spots would come out on your breasts when you showered, memories of a flesh I could not scar with my kisses or with my worship bless. It got hot again, but our summer's month was over. For as long as we were together, you held those bees against me. A swarm of bees in May is worth a load of hay. A swarm of bees in June is worth a silver spoon. A swarm of bees in July is not worth a fly. Commode, scarf, dresser, go get 'em chair. The sea green dish. The sliding shade, the flower, school of fish, my seed. And when we left that room, we left it just that way, the twisted, hammered towel, the tents, men, rifles turned to the wall, one torn orange, that heat and that humidity, dead bees crushed in the cloth. Thank you very much.